have to look at what the media is doing. I mean, we've seen campaigns to sell the war in Iraq. We've seen campaigns to sell other wars. This one is on a whole different level. Zelensky has been on the cover of Vogue. He has been the person of the year of Time magazine. He addressed the Oscars. He addressed the Grammys. He addressed the Cannes Film Festival. It is just amazing. The selling of Zelensky, the selling of this war. This is what we're up against.
That's Medea Benjamin, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Medea Benjamin on the selling of the Ukraine war. February 24th marks the first year anniversary of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Moscow's action is a clear violation of international law. But it was not unprovoked, as the politicians and the media keep repeating. The NATO military alliance has expanded its bases right up to Russia's borders. The U.S. and its NATO allies are sending more and more arms to Ukraine. Last week it was Patriot missiles. This week it's tanks. What will it be next week? Fighter jets? The steady escalation of weaponry is music to the ears of the military-industrial complex. The longer the war goes on, the more their cash registers go ka-ching. The continuation of the war is getting a hard sell from the armchair pundits and retired generals and their corporate media enablers. What will it take to stop the war? Our guest today is Medea Benjamin. She's a renowned peace activist and social justice advocate. She's co-founder of Code Pink and the recipient of the Martin Luther King Jr. Peace Prize and the Gandhi Peace Award. She's the author of many books, including Inside Iran, Kingdom of the Unjust, and War in Ukraine. She spoke in Chapel Hill, North Carolina on Martin Luther King Jr. Day in mid-January. And now, Medea Benjamin.
First, let me start by saying happy Martin Luther King Day. And this is certainly a day to reflect on Martin Luther King's Beyond Vietnam speech, his anti-war calling, what that cost him, the way that he was reviled when he came out against the Vietnam War, persona non grata in a lot of places, including the White House. And yet he said that it was his moral obligation to speak out against war. And certainly that one quote of his in that speech always sticks with me when we talk about a society that puts more money into the military than into social uplift is moving towards spiritual death. And he said that many decades ago, and unfortunately, I think it's still the case, especially when you see the recent budget that was passed of $858 billion for the Pentagon. That's not counting the money for Ukraine. That's not counting the money for nuclear weapons. You put that all together, and we're at about $1 trillion now. $1 trillion a year. And I have just arrived here today, so I don't know what your community is like, but I just came from Los Angeles, where the streets are lined with people that don't have housing, and where the schools are crumbling, where the infrastructure is terrible, where people can't find a good place to go to get decent health care, and where young people are paying absurd amounts of money for what they should get for free. In fact, they should get a stipend to do it, and that's to get a college education. So to think how we have evolved since the time of Martin Luther King, in some ways, of course, we have made progress. But we've not made progress in terms of where we spend our money, where we spend our resources. And we haven't made progress in terms of how we deal with conflict. And that's especially true after 9/11, when we've been involved in war after war after war. And I know some people in this room were active trying to stop the U.S. from responding to the 9/11 attacks by going to war. And thank you for the Veterans for Peace and others who do so much work on this issue. WILF, Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, so many groups. And so many of us that came out into the streets by the hundreds of thousands and said no to the war in Iraq, and the government wouldn't listen to us. And here we are 20 years later, and Iraq now has a government that is pro-Iran. Now, I don't say that's good or bad, but I'm just saying, what did 20 years of U.S. involvement do except for kill about a million Iraqis, destroy the lives of millions of people who had to flee their homes, kill so many of our own soldiers, and left Iraq in way worse shape than it was under the dictatorship of Saddam Hussein? And then you look at Afghanistan, where I have worked very recently to try to right the wrong of the U.S. not only being there for 20 years and then leaving the country in the hands of the Taliban and stealing the $7 billion that was their bank cash reserve for the whole country, where the U.S. has said, oh, put your money in the U.S. Federal Reserve. That's a safe place for it. And when the U.S. leaves, they leave and take the money, leaving Afghanistan in a catastrophic situation today with millions of people hungry. I was there quite recently visiting poor neighborhoods where you saw people that were drying grass so that they could boil it and feed it to their kids, people eating grass, people selling their kidneys to be able to feed their families. We went to one house and we were very concerned about the girls not being able to go to school. And I remember saying to this one mother surrounded by a couple of her children, you know, it's so sad that your girls can't go to school. And she said, our boys can't go to school either. We can't afford the pen, the paper, the books that they would need to go to school. And we have to send them out on the street to beg so we will have something to feed the rest of the family. That's the situation we left Afghanistan in after spending trillions of dollars. It really is sickening. And so some of us thought after the very chaotic exit that Biden oversaw leaving Afghanistan, that maybe there would be a peace dividend. Meaning maybe we, the taxpayers, would get to put our money into something other than a humongous Pentagon. But no, right after that war, now we're into another one. So I said I wanted to talk about some of the myths. And I think it's something that we hear over and over and over again when it comes to Ukraine, is that this is a war that is unjustified and unprovoked. And I want to say very clearly that I think it is totally unjustified, because I think war is unjustified. I don't think that we can say that with all the issues faced by Russia, they had the right to go in and invade a sovereign nation. And the brutality they are inflicting upon the Ukrainian people is tragic. Now they're using the tactic of blowing up the infrastructure, the electricity grids. And if you think you're cold in the winter here, think of what the winter is like in Ukraine. And think of what it's like when you don't have heating, when you don't have electricity. It is really tragic what is happening in Ukraine, but it has been provoked. And that is something that the American people don't understand, because either it isn't brought up or it's just poo-pooed. Oh, yes, the expansion of NATO, that really wasn't very important. You know what? It set the stage for this invasion. And there were so many warnings about it. In our book, we go page after page giving examples of the warnings from foreign policy experts who said this is a tragic mistake and it will cause instability in the region. From US officials who said it's a tragic mistake, it will cause instability in the region. From former ambassadors who said you find throughout Russia absolute opposition to the expansion of NATO. And so what did the US government do, whether it was a Democratic administration of Bill Clinton or whether it was a Republican administration of George Bush? Expand, expand, expand. And that is a provocation. Just think, if Mexico decided they wanted to go into an alliance with China or with Russia, would the US ever allow that? A military alliance? Would they ever allow that? Absolutely not. In fact, we're at the 200th anniversary this year of the Monroe Doctrine that said not only Mexico, but all of Latin America was our backyard, and we would not allow another power to come in and challenge us there. So here you have the expansion of NATO right up to the border of Russia, and you have US involvement directly in Ukrainian affairs. Now, we often hear about Russia's involvement in US affairs, Russiagate, and how Hillary Clinton only lost the election because of Russiagate. That's how Trump won. There was recently a very academic study that was done looking at the effects of the Russian trolls and said it had no impact. But the US certainly had an impact when it came to its intervention in Ukrainian affairs. And again, we go in our book into great detail. We talk about the National Endowment for Democracy and all the tax money that was poured into building pro-Western groups, anti-Russian groups. And then there was the Maidan uprising in 2014, which was a popular uprising against a democratically elected government, but a corrupt government. And people came out peacefully, large numbers of people, to protest that government. But it was hijacked. It was hijacked by right-wing paramilitary elements, and it was hijacked by US government officials. Now, we don't know the extent of US government involvement because these are things that we find out after the facts when there are more Freedom of Information requests that come out. But we have a leaked telephone call between the Assistant Secretary of State, Victoria Nuland, when she was talking to the US ambassador to Ukraine, when they were deciding who would be the ones that would be in charge of the government that would be overthrown. Literally saying who they wanted in power, who they wanted to sideline and keep on the outside. That was the famous quote in which they said, screw the EU, the European Union, we're going to be the ones to decide. And then you have Victoria Nuland that goes out into the streets of during the Maidan uprising, giving out sandwiches and cookies. Now, what if on January 6th, when there was an uprising in our capital in Washington, D.C., somebody from the Russian embassy came out and said, here are some sweets. Go and overthrow your government. We are with you. Well, it wouldn't have happened because all hell would have broken loose if it did. But that's what the US was doing. So provocation, provocation. And after the Maidan uprising and after it ended in a coup, and there was then a pro-Western government that was put into power, the pro-Russian part of the Donbas rebelled, broke away, and the Russians came in to take back Crimea. which had been given to Ukraine by Khrushchev. And the fighting started in the Donbas. So the fighting didn't just start on February 24th when the Russians invaded. The fighting has been going on for years now, since 2014. And the U.S. got very involved with the civil war that was going on in the Donbas by training Ukrainian soldiers and by sending weapons. Now, there was an agreement that was negotiated 1 year later in 2015 called the Minsk Agreements that was supposed to end the conflict. But what happened? The political part of the agreement was never fulfilled by the Ukrainian government. They were supposed to go talk to the leaders of the breakaway republic. They were supposed to then give autonomy to the region within the framework of being part of Ukraine. And that never happened. Zelensky, who campaigned as a pro-peace president and got overwhelming support for that stand, when he came into power and said he was going to go meet with the heads of the breakaway regions, was threatened with his life. He was told he would be hanging from a tree. And so the Minsk agreement was never implemented. Now, very recently, in the last couple of weeks, there were some quite remarkable revelations that we heard from the former chancellor of Germany, Angela Merkel, and from the former head of France, François Hollande. And both of them said that that Minsk agreement, which we all thought was supposed to end the conflict, was really meant to buy time for the Ukrainians to build up their military, for the West to send in the weapons, for them to be able to attack the Donbas and perhaps even be ready for a war with Russia. And so Russia learned just recently that they had been duped with that agreement, that it had never intended to be implemented. But here we have the conflict going on, the Russians deciding to invade on February 24th. I would say a terrible mistake that they did. Perhaps they had really bad intelligence, like the U.S. often gets really bad intelligence. Perhaps they thought they could easily go in and overthrow the government in Kyiv and put a pro-Russian government in place. That obviously did not happen. But we also see that the U.S. and the West was ready to take on this fight. And that the U.S. said that this was a fight between democracy and dictatorship. That we would have to get involved in this because this we have to defend democracies. Now, many of you who came, who work here on the issue of Israel-Palestine, know that the U.S. is oftentimes not on the side of democracies. In fact, in the case of Israel, we give them, what, about $4 billion every year to repress the Palestinian people. Egypt, we give about $2 billion a year to a repressive government that has about 60,000 political prisoners. We sell weapons to one of the most repressive regimes in the world, and that is Saudi Arabia. But the U.S. said, we have to get into this fight to defend democracy. And so we see this pouring in of weapons and weapons and training and weapons. And so here we are at a situation where we are being told that the way to victory in Ukraine is to send in more and more weapons. We are told that victory is around the corner, and all we have to do is give another 40 billion, another 30 billion, what was the latest, another 47 billion. And the narrative that we're hearing in the press is this narrative that there is a possibility of victory. Now, what does victory mean? The way we're hearing in the press it is that Ukraine will be able to take back every inch of territory that is controlled by Russia or pro-Russian forces, meaning all of the Donbas and all of Crimea, basically going back to 2014. But guess what? The military generals who know a losing war when they see it, the ones in the United States, they are saying victory on the battlefield is really not possible. You're hearing that from the number one military advisor to the president, and that is the chair of the Joint Chief of Staff, Mark Milley, who said the Ukrainians has done a courageous battle. They have won what they are going to win on the battlefield. Now is the time to seize the moment and go for negotiations. And it's not just what we're hearing or what they're saying inside the Pentagon. It's also what people are saying, what we're hearing from former generals in Europe as well. Very pessimistic that if this goes on and on, it could, as the head of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, a real war hawk, he said, his fear is that this will spin out of control. And if it goes wrong, he said, it can go horribly wrong. Horribly wrong means not just that Ukrainians will keep getting killed. It means that it will go and spin out into another country, a NATO country like Poland, which will mean Article 5 of NATO will be invoked, which means that we will have to get involved physically, militarily, and confront Russia directly. Spinning out of control horribly could also mean that Putin feels that he is pushed into a corner and would use a nuclear weapon. Now, it's so interesting that people who want us to keep pumping more weapons into Ukraine said, oh, Putin will never use a nuclear weapon, but they say he's a crazy man. Well, if he's a crazy man, maybe he would use a nuclear weapon. And so there are certainly people in the military who are very concerned about this possibility. And remember in 1962 when J.F. Kennedy was negotiating with Khrushchev because they knew they held the world in their hand and the possibility of a nuclear war was very real. They negotiated, they compromised. Russia took its nuclear weapons out of Cuba and the U.S. removed its missiles from Turkey. And JFK said, never, if you were in a confrontation with a nuclear power, never put them in a position of either a humiliating defeat or the use of a nuclear weapon. Is that where we are pushing Putin? So the people inside the military are really starting to question, where is this going? But we're not hearing that from our government officials. We're not hearing that from President Biden. We're not hearing President Biden said, oh, I think I better start talking to Putin. He hasn't talked to Putin in this entire time. It's going on a year. You're not hearing the Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, say, oh, I think we better start talking to my counterpart, Lavrov, in Russia. No. What you're seeing only is that the head of the CIA, William Burns, by the way, he was in Russia during the time of the early NATO expansion and talked about what a disaster it was back then. He has met with his counterpart. Jake Sullivan, National Security Council, has met with his counterpart, and so has Lloyd Austin, the Secretary of Defense. They are meeting not to come up with a peace plan, but they are meeting to see how they can stop this from spinning out of control. But we need the civilians in our government. We need the Secretary of State, and we need the President to get on board to push for negotiations. And you know how they say the excuse, nothing for Ukraine without Ukraine. We can't convince the Ukrainians to go for negotiations. Well, guess what? If you said there was no longer a blank check, the Ukrainians would have to negotiate. There also have been attempts at negotiations. There was a very good attempt at negotiations right a month after the Russian invasion, when Erdogan and Turkey was mediating, and you had both sides that came up with a 15-point peace plan. And the peace plan included that Ukraine would be a neutral state, that it recognized that it would not be able to join NATO, but that its neutrality and its sovereignty would be guaranteed by strong states. Russian troops would leave. There would be a negotiated process for the Donbas, so there could be internationally monitored elections there, so the people there could decide for themselves how they wanted to be affiliated. And they talked about the issue of Crimea being bumped down the road. They would deal with that in the coming years. It could be as long as 15 years away. A very positive peace process that was in the works until Boris Johnson, the head of the UK at that time, came and said, the collective West does not want to see you negotiate a deal with Russia. We are in this with you for victory. And then Lloyd Austin also came from the US and said that we must weaken Russia. And so you saw the peace talks were cut off. There have been talks, though, on small things, and I think it's important to mention that, because what I hear a lot is people say, you can't talk to Putin, you can't talk to Russia. Well, let's recognize, not only were those talks happening before they were sabotaged, but the Ukrainians and the Russians have also talked about some very serious things, and successfully. For example, you remember a couple of months ago when it looked like the largest nuclear power plant in all of Europe, the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, was going to be blown up, that there were shelling coming from both sides, and they sat down and they negotiated and they agreed that the International Atomic Energy Association would come in and calm the situation down. There have also been successful negotiations about the grain trade, because who knew before this happened that Ukraine and Russia were responsible for so much of the exports of grain around the world? And it was so important to get this grain out to countries in Africa and the Middle East who were so desperately in need of that grain. And so they negotiated a land corridor and a sea corridor to get over 10 million tons of grain out of Ukraine and to get more fertilizers out from Russia, because they were on the sanction list and then got lifted from the sanction list. Happened through negotiations. And a third area of negotiations that is ongoing is prisoner swaps. Now, we heard about the prisoner swap with Brittany Griner, and that was between the US and Russia. But there have been prisoner swaps going on constantly between Ukraine and Russia. We don't hear about them very often, if at all, but there have been probably about 24 prisoner swaps. The last one I heard was on January 8th. And imagine all the work that goes into one prisoner swap, and some of them are hundreds of prisoners, in negotiating who's going to get traded for who, how it's going to happen, the trust that's built up that each side is going to do what they say. So there have been negotiations on some of these issues. What we need to get, of course, is negotiations on how to stop this war. And that's where we come in. Because in our Congress, we are certainly not getting even the discussion about that.
You're listening to Medea Benjamin on the selling of the Ukraine war. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us at 1-800